Today's episode of More Than One Thing is sponsored by Jo Malone London. I love how something as simple as the warmth and fragrance of a burning candle has the ability to envelop your senses and transport you to a fond memory, which is so important now as we spend more time at home. Jo Malone London has always looked at stories and moments in time to capture those magic moments in their candles, and I'm excited to tell you more about their new townhouse collection. The Jo Malone London Townhouse Collection is inspired by celebratory scenes and a classic London townhouse. Each of the six scented candles has its own specific mood, unique design, and an enchanting story to tell. What truly captured my attention was the elegantly understated design of the vessels themselves. Carefully crafted in unglazed white ceramic and detailed with the finer features of Georgian architecture. To discover the Jo Malone London Townhouse Collection for yourself, visit jomalone.com. Welcome to More Than One Thing with me, Athena Calderon. The podcast focused on non-traditional career paths, creative endeavors, and the ever-evasive multi-hyphenate. We live in a world today which encourages us to be the multifaceted humans that we are, though we're still subjected to antiquated pressures to follow a single path to success. But there is so much beauty to be found in our complexities, and I want to encourage you to embrace your full self. This is a podcast about taking the road less traveled to find your passion and purpose while navigating the hurdles and hoops we all jump through on this personal and creative journey. I'm your host, Athena Calderon, author, interior designer, chef, recipe developer, entertaining expert, creative director, stylist, product designer, storyteller, editor, and certified oversharer. Does that sound like an insanely long way to describe my career? Well, it is, and that's exactly why we're all here. Every week, I'll be sitting down with another multi-hyphenate who I admire deeply to talk through their struggles, vulnerabilities, and eventual successes throughout their long and winding journey to where they are now. Because it's in other stories, I believe, we can always see a little piece of ourselves. Today's guest is poet, community builder, artist, activist, mother, speaker, and my friend, Cleo Wade. If you're among her nearly 1 million Instagram followers, then you're already familiar with her deeply expressive poems and her powerful affirmations. If you're just hearing of her now, then there's one thing that you should know. Cleo Wade adores you. Whatever she does, from her public art installations to her handwritten poetry, to her tireless work as an activist, Cleo has many ways of fulfilling her singular mission, to care. Crowned the poet of her generation by Time and the millennial Oprah by New York Magazine, Cleo uniquely and succinctly captures the energy of our times. Her words often end up on posters at protests and all across the internet. Her best-selling books, Heart Talk and Where to Begin, are a tool for readers. Filled with loving mantra, her poems reassure you the way that a best friend might, that you're going to be okay. Born and raised in New Orleans, Cleo fell in love with words after attending a poetry camp at the age of 6. Initially, though, she followed her creative drive in a different direction. Cleo forewent college for an internship with M. Missoni in New York City, and by 19, she had a job at the fashion house Halston and soon found herself at the center of the New York fashion scene. But she knew she had more to offer the world and herself. Her life changed when, in 2014, she posted her now infamous poem, "Dearest, I'm writing you this letter to inform you of my unbreakable nature. That's all. Love, women everywhere." Now, whether traveling around the country on her sold-out book tours, creating art installations, or writing from her home in California as she takes on her newest role, mother to her daughter, Memphis Love, Cleo continues to show us that her love and career are ever evolving. I couldn't be more excited to welcome Cleo Wade to More Than One Thing. Cleo, welcome.
Hi, I'm so happy to be here, wherever here is, together.
I just want to jump off by saying that you most certainly seem like one of these people that always has a lot happening. It never seems to be one thing or the other, that it can be it all. And I'd love for you to define, in your own words, what being a multi-hyphenate means to you.
To me, I think being a multi-hyphenate means having the freedom to give every life within you a life outside of you. And so, you know, we have so many versions of ourselves and parts of ourselves that are just looking to be liberated and be given a space to run wild or be creative or be curious. And I think that when you limit yourself to one box, you do a disservice to all of what's inside of you. It's funny because your podcast is called More Than One Thing. And something I always say is that, you know, there's not a single person that is just one thing. You know, like there's not the thing. There's so much happening inside of us. And I think also so much of what makes us feel sad sometimes are the unlived lives within us.
Absolutely. Did you always feel this way, or did you ever feel like you needed to define yourself as a singular thing, singular vocation?
I don't know if I ever felt that I needed to be one thing, but I do think that I was afraid to name whatever it is I thought I was. I've definitely been kind of young and trying to figure it out and had a job that had a title, but was probably didn't want to call myself that because I felt like it wasn't the real me. And so I think that it wasn't until I realized I could be more than one thing that I wasn't afraid to say, like, yes, I'm an artist or a poet and I make things with words and I am an active citizen and I could feel the freedom. I mean, I remember one day a friend of ours, Sade, said to me, don't try to fit yourself into a box. She was like, take every box that you think is interesting and fit it into your box.
That's powerful.
Oh, it was the best advice I've ever gotten. And I think she said it to me when I was 23. And it changed my life because I think that I was trying to say, like, okay, I guess I have to say I'm this. And then everything else is either a secret project, you know, a secret labor of love or a side hustle or whatever. And now I don't really even believe in side hustles or, you know, passion projects as much because I think that we minimize them, you know, and I think that just because something, you know, writing was not something that paid my rent for a really long time, but it didn't make me feel like I wasn't a writer.
Right. At what point were you able to own it more?
Writer is actually a lot more socially acceptable than poet. Right. Poet was really hard because, you know, when I was started out, I mean, it really didn't exist. If you said, like, I'm a poet, people were like, huh, like, what's your real job?
Right.
And my boyfriend at the time lived in DC. And so I was in DC a lot and I was always around these kind of like people with like very kind of serious, kind of classic type of jobs. You know, they worked in politics or they were a lawyer. And I would be the only person who's like in the room being like, I'm a poet. And they were like, huh? But, you know, the thing is that it did help me kind of build a thick skin because I remember thinking, oh, my God, I feel so insecure having to say this because I saw how people looked at me and I'd have more than one person say to me, yeah, but what do you really do or how do you really pay your rent? And I was like, well, that's not the question you asked. I was like, I consult with some companies, but I also didn't want to, you know, you know what it's like when you have like a passive income, but it's not really what you feel that your identity is, right? And so
right.
I didn't want to put on the map the space of my life I didn't want to grow in. You know, I wanted to kind of push myself to put on the map the space of my life I did want to grow in.
Yeah.
And so I definitely remember thinking, everyone looks at me like I'm crazy. And I definitely felt really insecure because I think I was probably also one of the younger people in the room every time. But I was like, listen, if I'm afraid to be uncomfortable, then I have no business chasing my dream anyway. So I remember having a mantra at the time that was, the discomfort isn't going to kill me, you know, and not going after what I want and living in fear of the discomfort could.
That's powerful. So did you have to really choose to censor yourself from thinking that way, or did you kind of train your brain?
You know, I kind of just have a mentality. I mean, first of all, my writing and even my kind of active citizenship or engaged citizenship is all a side effect of my spiritual journey. And so at the height of probably when I was the most spiritually kind of fit and healthy, and you know, when you just have those moments in life where you're just like reading the right books and having the right revelations and like learning self-care for the first time and stripping away all of the shit you don't need. And you're like, whoa, like I just found something in me that wasn't there. You know, that was when I wrote Heart Talk. That was when I was like, I have like power. I need to get involved in my community. I could be doing more than what I'm doing. And I think the first self-help book I'd ever read was The War of Art. And it's just like a really crazy motivator. And I'd never really read a book like that because I come from like a poor family in the South. Like there's not therapy in our culture. There's not really a ton of therapy historically in Black culture. And so I didn't, you know, come from a place where if things don't feel right, you find tools and resources. It's more like if things don't feel right, you find numbing aids and distractions.
Yeah.
And same. So for me, it's like, I was like, okay, whoa, there's a totally different way you could deal with this. It's not just doing what you can to kind of get by and be wild and have a good time and just feel whatever, you know, just get away from yourself. Actually, the answer is diving further into yourself. Holy shit. Where my self-esteem was so rooted in spiritually, like how kind of healthy my heart was. And so I think because of that, I had a little bit more bravery with my words. And it also just kind of made sense to me. I thought about going through history and thinking, God, there's always been a concept of manifesting or spells or whatever. And whether you believe in that or don't, or prayer, it's about knowing that your words are a part of your energy and they build something. And I always say to my girlfriends when they're talking about themselves or their dreams or their hopes or their aspirations, what if every single one of your words was a spell? And if in a spell, in order for it to work, it has to be so precise and so accurate. And if one thing is off, the entire kind of cauldron explodes. How intentional would you be with how you speak about yourself? And so that was something I felt very early in my kind of writing journey and kind of validating myself journey and introducing myself into a world that didn't really tell me I should definitely exist. And so I think because that was really my mentality, like that's where my head was, I just knew it was important because, you know, that made so much sense to me then and it still makes sense to me now.
Can you define or share like when that moment was that you kind of found yourself rooted in the voice that we all know you to have right now? Like, was there a defining moment that suddenly you said to yourself, I want to be everyone's best friend in my writing?
Do you remember that little book I made where it was like a little hand? I feel like you were there, but I did it. It was at Francesco Clemente's studio. I like hand sewn them and they were really cool. And I remember, but it was kind of like this work that it was like photos and collages and poetry. And it was, and my first inspirations were really more like Jenny Holzer or Barbara Kruger. And even how I made some of my earlier money to kind of help support me was I would privately sell those paintings. And I remember one day Francesco said to me, he was like, the words are the best thing, but that's the thing you're the most afraid of. Because if someone didn't like it, he is like, I think that's where your feelings would be the most hurt because I can tell that's what you care about the most. He's like, so if you can get over that fear and focus on the words, then your entire life could change. And it was interesting because while I still do paint and like to make artwork, I do realize that it is actually rooted in the words and that I needed to really take time to focus on, you know, what did I really want to say rather than kind of half devoting myself to the words, half devoting myself to the aesthetic of the words, you know, whether it's a painting or drawing on a mirror or, you know, something I wrote on it's the side of a building with a Sharpie. So I remember later in that year, I got a little pink typewriter. And for a year, I just focused on the words. And I typed it on a typewriter because I knew that I'd have to be so much more intentional because I couldn't just backspace or get distracted on my computer or get transported from this place to this place. And I wrote thousands and thousands of poems, you know, on that typewriter over the years. And I realized that I was like, you know, I really took a year to say, like, if I even sat down at a restaurant, I mean, you know, you have post-its of mine where I just wrote something and handed it to you. And you remember we'd be at a dinner in New York and I would have a paint kit with me and just paint a poem on a postcard at the table. And it was actually because I was always trying to make sure that I lived the thing I was focusing on and brought it with me every single place I went.
Oh, I love that.
I think, you know, for me, once I'd also had that really devoted practice to writing, then I don't feel like after that anyone could like tell me I wasn't a poet or a writer, whether I'd published a book or not, or it was on Instagram or not. And, you know, I want to write this for like the little black girl in New Orleans who is me and was 13 and needed these words. And like, she's never going to find them if they're on a gallery wall.
Wow.
I was like, I don't care about high art. I think that accessibility is just one of the most interesting and inspiring things. I began to become really passionate about figuring out ways to make things in a price point that, you know, my 20-year-old shitty job self could have afforded, right. You know, and would make me feel happy, whether it was like hanging in my walls at home, you know, on a sweatshirt or just, by the way, free on Instagram. And right. So I remember thinking, it wasn't that I was like, I want to be everyone's best friend, but I was like, I do think that the thing I'm the best at is being a best friend. And if I could do the thing I feel that I'm the best at, that I enjoy doing the most, I think I'd always enjoy my work and I could be of service in a real way. And so I was open to whatever that looked like. And on some days it looked like an Instagram post for people. On some days it looked like, you know, the beginning of writing Heart Talk and then putting it into the world. On some days it looked like writing a poem that became my TED Talk and then became my second book, Where to Begin. I didn't have like I had a rock bottom moment, but I had I did have a moment where I was like, I feel that I should be happier than I am. You know, I definitely felt that way in my early 20s. And I was like, well, and then that's when I started kind of looking at the tools of like self-improvement or finding happiness and realizing that there are tools and that you can go to therapy and you can read self-help books and you can kind of listen to thought leaders on personal healing. And I was like, this is it for me.
Was that around the time that you started the Are You Okay booths? Because I'd love for you to talk about that initial idea and how it's evolved over the years. Can you describe to our listeners what it is in case they don't know?
The Are You Okay booth is a booth that kind of looks like the little stand that Lucy from the Peanuts has that says psychiatry, 5 cents. But it says, Are You Okay? Free, peaceful, and loving conversations on the front. I set them up at public parks. I'd announced on Instagram like an hour before. So there weren't, in the beginning, like there was no one really there. And I remember I had this one guy who came and he was really skeptical and he just happened to be in the park meeting he was like waiting for someone and he was like, what are you doing? Oh, do you have like a record coming out or something? And I was like, I'm actually tone deaf, so no. And he was like, do you want like, and I was like, just sit down, just like talk to me. And he starts talking to me about how him and his wife had kids later than his other friends. And so while his other friends are all becoming empty nesters, he is at home with the kids and he just doesn't know how he feels about it while at the same time trying to enjoy that they're there. And, you know, he lived in New Jersey and it was like, it was the guy that you're like, never thought you'd see at like one of my book events or like.
Yeah. And he really opened up, it sounds like.
And it took him a while because at first he was like, oh yeah. Like he just kept trying to like poke to say like, what's the thing? Like, is the camera going to pop out from somewhere? Is this real? Is this? And it's funny because all throughout my career, I think I constantly bump up against, this can't be real. She must be fake. And so I'm kind of used to it. And I have a little bit of a like threshold for impatience for it. And so I just sat there and I sat there talking to him for like 25 minutes maybe. And when he left, I'll never forget it because he was the first person who ever sat down with me at my Are You Okay booth. He walked away and then he turned around and he goes, hey. And I was like, yeah. And he goes, thanks for loving me. And it was this guy. And I was like, you're welcome anytime.
Oh my goodness. I've read and I know this about you, but that you've always said that kind of the way to happiness is to be of service to other people. So was this an intentional way for you to be of service?
You know, so much of it was an experiment, just like so many things we do, right? You know, you're like, you don't know. It's like, I'd love to say that we think that we know we're doing the wise, spiritual, generous giving thing in the moment. But really, I was really curious and I wasn't afraid of why I was curious about something. And so I was like, I'm just going to do it. Like, this seems kind of weird. I get that it could be random. I feel like there's something there. I feel like there's a reason why there's a part of me that wants to sit outside and talk to strangers or not strangers. I actually hate the word strangers. I say people I haven't met yet. But I felt that there was a reason that called me to do it. And I think that be after doing that and a lot of other ways I live my life, whether that's kind of the time I spend at the Girls Club or with the Women's Prison Association, I think that's really where I was able to develop that kind of personal ethos of if and when and how service can be at the root of living your life, the life feels well lived every time.
I love that. You've done so many incredible things in your career, and one of them was a TED Talk called Want to Change the World? Start by being brave enough to care. So how did that happen? And how did you stand up on that stage? And I'm sure battled anxiety and fear for it being such a huge moment and be able to remain standing in your truth and in your confidence.
Well, you know, that talk was one of the first times I ever spoke publicly.
Oh, wow.
And so it's really funny because to hear say, like, anytime I hear anyone be like, oh, you're so confident there, you're like, really? Because I'll never forget the kind of the most lighthearted part of the story that I'll share first is that, you know, I was so nervous and I had this like very sick teal dress on because as you know me, I'm all about like, okay, what's my, like the first thing is like, yes, I want to do it. And the next I'm like, okay, but what am I going to wear? Because like, I do feel that clothes help kind of put you in the mood. It can be the first step in confidence a lot of the time. So I had this very sick dress. I think it was Ferragamo, but it was teal. And I was so afraid that I was going to sweat through the dress because I was sweating. Like I was so nervous. And so I remember right before I get on the stage, I'm sitting there and I'm standing over a garbage can and right before me happened to be Christy Turlington. And she comes off stage just being this like floating goddess, just like classic her, right? You know, just like a beautiful, like graceful, like gazelle. And I look up and I see her midway through pulling the tissue out of the armpits of my dress to put them in the garbage can right before I go out. So that
classy.
I was like, can I go out with this, like these tissues in my armpits? Like, I'm not sure. But I was like, and so I was so nervous. But I'll say about the process of TED is that TED reached out to me and asked me for a pitch because basically they'll ask you kind of what would you want to talk about? And then they'll approve your pitch. And then you have like a call with like a board basically. And the board has to approve your pitch and then they'll invite you to speak. What's really cool about having the board, and there's this amazing woman who's kind of the head of the board. Her name's Pat Mitchell and she's a badass. And they'll work with you on your talk. So I remember kind of I had two meetings at the TED office in New York as I was developing the talk. Mm-hmm. I rehearsed it for them more than once.
How nerve-wracking.
Yeah, it was really nerve-wracking. And more than anything, because I hadn't done a lot of public speaking at the time and I still have struggled with it over the years. I mean, I still am pulling those Kleenexes out of my armpits. But, you know, as a woman, I didn't realize where I had such a deep self-worth issue because I kept thinking, who would listen to me for 20 minutes? Who wants to listen to anyone for more than 3 minutes? I was thinking I could give an answer to something, but I just couldn't imagine that anyone would want, you know, to allow me to take up space for 30 minutes. Like even now when I get asked to do, you know, speak at a university or at a company, I'm always like, you want me to talk for an hour? Me? Like, am I allowed to take up that much space? And I did realize just how much kind of society puts those kind of narratives in women's heads and in people of color's heads, which is like, gosh, I never realized how much I did try to get by without taking up as much space as possible. And think that that was part of, it's like that accommodating thing, right? You know, like pleasant women are women who don't take up all the space in the room and actually like hold space in the room for others and are just this like really accommodating presence rather than a centering presence.
Yeah.
And so I ended up kind of going through the rehearsals and really working on, more than anything, having like the self-esteem to take up space for 10 minutes to do the talk. And I think especially at that point in time, because I knew that the talk I pitched to them is that I wanted to talk about how our micro actions create a macro impact on the world. And as I developed it, they were like, you know, this is going to be recorded in November live, but we'll probably want to release it on Inauguration Day.
Oh, wow.
And so I was like, okay. And I just kept thinking to myself, well, what would I want to tell my friends and family on that day? You know, I really kind of like zoomed in where I was like, and my friends and family being, some people are Trump supporters, some people are, you know, the most liberal people in the world, people from all walks of life. And I just thought, what would I want my kids, I didn't have yet, but what would I want them to know? What would I want to say to them? And even in the beginning of the talk, I talk about, you know, because the place I started was with Sade's child, Thelonious, because one of my best friends, who you know really well too, Sade, had just had a baby. And I was like, I literally, my starting point was, what are all the things I wish that Thelonious could know as he comes into the world? And that was the talk.
How did you feel after you delivered the talk? Because I think a lot about the differences between internal versus external validation. And I'm just curious if you're ever, you know, if it's challenging to separate those two things, because this was a big moment in your life.
You know, it was definitely a big moment, but I think that that's why it's always been important to me to root where I feel good. You know, I try never to have to feel validated, because I do feel that's like a power source outside of us. But mm-hmm. I do try to feel good. You know, I try to feel good through self-care. I try to feel good through who I'm around and how I spend my time. And I think that I definitely took the time, you know, that TED Talk happened to that year have been in my hometown. So it was cool because my parents were there. And, you know, I definitely had a party at my house after, and I felt good because it was hard. And I think that it's always okay to have moments of being like, I did something that was really hard and I'm proud of myself for that. And there's nothing wrong with being proud of myself.
Of course.
And I think that for me, one of the things I wrote in Heart Talk was, if you give anything or anyone the power to make you feel like you're on top of the world, you give them equal power to make you feel like the weight of the world is on your shoulders. And when I wrote that, Heart Talk wasn't out then, but I'd already written it. And so I knew that mantra. And I kind of like keep it with me all the time, because I'm very much the person who's like, I'm always up to have a good time around doing something that I was afraid to do or kind of accomplishing something I was proud of, but I'm always ready to keep it moving. And I think that also when you root your life in service, you know, you never feel like you're done, right? It's good because it keeps my goals moving and it keeps me in a flow, because I do think that, you know, sometimes, you know, we might be the person who like puts the book out and then wonders who we are after we're not promoting the book. And that's hard.
Yeah. That is hard. I want to talk about how you've made, obviously, words and poetry your brand, but in thinking about the youth of our generation that does not want to explore a nonlinear path, are you open to kind of sharing how you've had to find creative ways to monetize yourself, your brand, beyond the books? Because I feel like you've done an exceptional job of creating viable revenue streams through poetry.
Oh, yeah. I mean, I remember thinking when I wanted to get out of the world that I didn't feel was me. And it's not like I purposefully try to exclude that part of my life out of my narrative, but like sometimes I just don't like to waste too much breath on the bad day job you had.
Yeah. You know?
But I do remember thinking like, okay, when I'm going to stop kind of like consulting or being in this environment that I, you know, frankly hated, I thought really intentionally about what is it to be a poet? You know, it's not Maya Angelou. It's just not. Books don't sell the same way. And frankly, like my interests weren't limited too. And by the way, neither, you know, Dr. Angela is. I mean, she wrote plays and danced and sang and directed and wrote films and, I mean, did a million things. But I guess my first question I asked myself was, what does it look like to have creative freedom where I need creative freedom the most? Mm. And so for me, I never wanted to compromise on what I wrote in a book. And so I would make sure that I didn't take something where like the deadline had to be done because if I didn't turn the book in, I couldn't pay my rent. I wanted to always be able to take as much time and put the exact amount of love and energy, or I didn't want to compromise, you know, going with this publisher or working with this person over this person because of money. And so I really opened myself up to what are all the ways that you can find monetary streams to support the bigger mission. And in part of that, I really stopped using the word brand early on. I remember with some of my first employees, I was like, you know, we're not a company that is on brand, we're on mission. Because I do feel a lot of the times when we use the word brand, it separates us from the thing. You know, we act like there's certain ways where like we're allowed to act because it's the brand. And it's like, well, if the brand, quote unquote, is rooted in your personhood, then you're never really separated from it. You were always the thing, the brand, and the brand was always you. And like, it's inauthentic to think that there could be a difference. I feel like I get how to authentically exist in this space by creating impact in how I exist in this space. And so one of the things I did really early on and has always been a part of the mission is saying like, call me whatever you want to call me. You want to call it like influencing, you want to call it like modeling, whatever anyone wants to call it. I don't really care. But like, I know that we've raised hundreds and thousands of dollars for organizations since I got an Instagram account. And I'm proud of that every day. And so I think that that helped me not be afraid to do something that I wasn't like, I wasn't sure, you know, how to authentically exist in that. And then, you know, beyond that, I think that for anyone who's looking for ways to monetize what they're interested in, I think first you really have to ask yourself, what is the thing? And for me, it's the words, right? So then I just think like, what are all the things I can do with the words? I guess I could put the words on a print and I could sell the print. Mm-hmm. Okay, I can do that with the words. And I was like, okay, what else can I do with the words? Okay, we could put them on a sweatshirt and raise money for Stacey Abrams. Okay. Oh, you know what else we could do with the words? Like we could make Kamala Harris our next vice president's first official campaign merch. And that's how we ended up being able to donate to the campaign because every single cent of that goes to the campaign. So we were able to raise hundreds of thousands of dollars for candidates who were important to me.
So everything, you have this mission that you're on and you bring everything that's presented to you to that.
When you do that, you're free, you know, because you're like, you do what Sade told me, right? It's like, figure out how to fit those things into your box. Instead of being like, you know, I know so many people that are like, I need to be a serious actress, so I can't be on Instagram, or I can't do this, or I need to be a serious this, that, or the other, so I can't look like I'm an influencer. And I'm like, all of those things can like work for you. Why would we be afraid to just do as much as we can with what we've got, you know? And for me, I have definitely over the years become a more is more person because we're able to do so much more for the communities that are important to me.
Yeah. I was on your Instagram and you did an Instagram live and you talked about your mantra for anxiety. Mm. And first of all, it helped me so much. And this was in your most recent book, The Journal, right?
It's in The Journal and it's also in Where to Begin.
Right. You said something, and I don't know if you were reading from the book or if you were just talking, but you talked about how that people often assume and have this idea of who you are, that you're always in a good mood mm-hmm. and that you've actually moved in and out of depressive phases and mm-hmm. that you've had to lean on friends to manage stress and that you've created this mantra for yourself and for all of us. Thank you very much, Cleo, to help you manage your anxiety. And I would love for you to talk about that. A lot of people have assumptions about a lot of people, but there is a lot of inner work that we have to do to be okay to manage anxiety.
So the mantra for anxiety is, these feelings are not you. They are moving through you. They can go out the same door they came in. And I think that if you even have the ability to witness it, then like you are not the thing. Like it is not you. Mm-hmm. And one of the ways that I practice that with my words to myself is I never affirm things I don't want to live in my body. So I would never say I have anxiety or I am anxious. I would never say I have trauma or I am traumatized. I say I move through anxiety frequently. I'd say I work through trauma. I've worked through trauma my entire life. And I think that not owning them and allowing them to call you home by treating them like permanent fixtures has been so helpful on my own journey. And that was why I wanted to share it. And it's funny because there is a section of the Heart Talk Journal that just is like a spending a week to write about and work on anxiety. But when I originally put that in Where to Begin, it's the most random part of the book because like everything about Where to Begin is about like how to participate in the world. And it's like, it's a very like off theme for everything else. And it was the last thing I ended up putting in the book because I was like, you know what? All this stuff about being good at being in the world is not possible if you are, you know, feel that you are 50 feet below a wave of anxiety. And so I was like, I'm just going to put this in. It really has not, I don't even know where to put it. It like doesn't really flow from one thing to the next. So I was like, but I am going to write about this and share this because I feel, you know, this tool has been so critical for me. And, you know, anxiety, I wrote about it in Heart Talk too. It's like anxiety disconnects us from our power, you know? And I think that, you know, to know, to be in relationship with uncomfortable feelings is a really healthy way to look at them because it's being in relationship with rather than identifying ourselves by.
That's really powerful. When you're a creative, there's a lot of unknowns and there's a lot of second guessing and there's a lot of shame and there's a lot of uncertainty. And you want to trust your gut and you want to follow your intuition, but so much of that gets really muddled and cloudy. And I would imagine that you've struggled with a similar path as you came to embrace yourself as a writer and as a poet. So do you have specific mantras for each of, for shame or for uncertainty, or can you talk a little bit about that?
I mean, I use the anxiety one really frequently. I probably use the one for shame the most because I don't know anyone who doesn't have shame. I don't know anyone who came out of like the womb is like the perfectly woke, like knowing all the right things to do in politics, caring about politics. I mean, I remember the apolitical times of my life. I talked a lot about like my quote unquote pre-woke period, you know, and so there's so much shame in that. And so one of my, probably the mantra I use the most because I think shame is probably the most
universal feeling.
And it's like the most persistent. Like I feel like shame is like the major stalker of all the emotions. Like that shame, it just feels like you just never shake shame. Like I don't care. Like there's just no, you know, shame you're also in a relationship with. It's never, you know, sometimes it's like a distant cousin and sometimes it's like literally your roommate, like just kind of living with you. And but my mantra for it that has been the most helpful is if you are grateful for where you are, you have to respect the road that got you there. And that's the mantra because it's not like the road that got you there. It's not like love it. It's not find joy in it. It's like respect it. You know, you have to respect that little like jerk you used to be, you know, and you respect kind of moving through those phases because, you know, if you didn't know how much you didn't like that. And even like there's so much spiritual healing in knowing what it's like to be a person who you didn't like.
Yes.
You know, because you're like, well, there was some goodness in me that knew that this was wrong because it made me miserable. And then finding and learning how to be the person you do like investing in that relationship with yourself is so freaking cool. And that's where I think you find that gratitude. But I don't think that it comes from ignoring the person you used to be or hating them or damning them or trying to sugarcoat them or put rose-colored glasses on when you look at them. It's like being like, yeah, that sucked. You sucked. And, you know, it would have been cool if you would have known better and could have done better then, but you didn't. And like, perhaps if you didn't have that little scar, you wouldn't know that like the oven was hot.
Absolutely.
And you can't touch it that long.
Yes. Everyone that comes on the podcast, I ask them two questions. One of them is, as you think back as you've navigated your creative journey, your personal journey, what would you say is your significant hurdle that you've faced and how you moved past it? Like what the roadblocks were, what the fears were, and then, you know, how did you move through it?
You know, I think it's kind of what we've talked about. It's like when you want to be something that you just don't see, you're like, can I do that? You know, can you just decide that? And I remember even writing in Heart Talk, if you want to be a singer, just sing your song, you know, and that to me was the most important thing. It's like, if you want to be a writer, then say you were a writer and of course write and be the first person who, you know, validates and we have the ability to qualify ourselves. And the reason I know that for sure is because I had to do it. Because when I was telling you earlier, being in those stuffy rooms in DC and saying I was a poet was crazy. Yeah. It was crazy at the time. It was wild. And it was so hard to have so many people look at you and think, no. And by the way, I said that way before I had a book out or anything else. And there was no kind of outside validation I could have even, you know, in a moment of insecurity, tried to lean on. And so I think that, you know, the biggest hurdle was definitely saying, I want to be this thing. I'm really afraid because it doesn't exist in the world, but I do think that I could do it. And I remember even at the time, my parents, because I did have, you know, a day job that had a steady paycheck, and my parents were like, are you sure? Because, you know, for my parents, like the goal is just a steady paycheck. You know, my dad is so, he's really supportive. And, you know, I think that even one of the ways that I could get through so much of my childhood living in such a racist place or going to such racist schools is and never feeling that I couldn't handle it was because my dad like gasses us up so much. Like even yesterday, yeah. It was so funny. My dad was over and he hugged me goodbye. And I had some friends outside who were kind of like sitting outside of my house. And my dad hugs me and in my ear whispers, you are so special and you're fucking cool. And then left.
Oh my God, I love him. That's amazing. But even he at the time wasn't like, he was a little uncertain that you could make a career as a poet.
Him, I mean, everyone, you know, I mean, I think if it weren't for, you know, some of my closest girlfriends at the time, I don't know. Like, it was crazy because, you know, my parents do believe in me and they did believe in me. And that's when I kind of had this revelation that I was like, wow, you know, to do the really big things, sometimes you have to believe in yourself even more than the people who believe in you. Yeah. And tapping into that was such a superpower because it helped me to take the risks that I needed to build what I've, you know, now built today.
Well, it didn't exist before you built it.
And now it's so cool because it's like, you know, my friend Phil was saying yesterday, he's like, the amount of people that were there, it's like me or like Rupi, you know, there's a whole new generation of people reading poetry and loving poetry. And I'm so happy to have been a part of, you know, the movement that kind of brought that into, you know, I can't tell you how many people have come to my book tours and been like, I never read poetry before. I hated it before.
Yeah.
I've never liked it. And I always say to them, I didn't like it either until I read what I did like. And a lot of the times, like, you know, it may not be the poems that, you know, you're taught in high school, and it might not be Shakespeare because maybe your first poem you needed to read was Mary Oliver or Nikki Giovanni, and that just wasn't in your grammar school.
Yeah.
Or like Rumi or Hafiz, you know, those weren't, if that would have been in one of my high school poetry classes, golly.
I know. I mean, I only discovered poetry and mostly Mary Oliver way later in life, like through yoga, through my yoga exploration. And It just, you know, found me. And I read poetry every morning. It's the first thing I do.
Yeah. And it's such a blessing.
Such a blessing. Yes. So can you share a moment when you felt as though you finally embraced yourself? Whether it could be, you know, you're embracing yourself, whether you feel embraced by other people, but that moment when you stood in I am instead of am I with a question mark?
So you sent me this question ahead of time and I had to think about it. And I'd never really thought about this before. And I was like, when did I feel that way? And it's interesting because I felt that way. New York Magazine asked to do an article on me. And it then I think became the cover of The Cut for that month or like an insert cover. I can't remember. It was something like that. And it was the first time, you know, I didn't have a publicist at the time or, a team or anyone who worked with me. It was really early. It was early summer of 2016. And the writer was this writer who I love and still love, Lizzie Goodman, who is just freaking so cool. And she, you know, came to my house every day. And I never knew about, I didn't know that they still did those kind of like almost famous type of journalism pieces. Like, I didn't know about that, like it still existed that someone would, she came to Philadelphia with me to knock doors. Like, I didn't know that like,
wow,
I'm traveling.
I didn't know.
Yeah. You know, like, I feel like nowadays it's just like, they call you or like, maybe you do it in person and meet for tea or something. And Lizzie had come over to my house a bunch of times. And it was, you know, it was like still to this day, probably the longest article that's ever been written about me. And they titled it, "Is Cleo Wade the Millennial Oprah?" And
amazing.
You know, what was interesting is that the reason I'm choosing this as the moment where I thought I am is not at all because that was the title of the article, but because when I answered the questions, and it was probably because Lizzie is such a good writer too, so she's really good at making you feel comfortable and she's just cool. But it was the first time I felt that I was like completely honest. You know, I do think that sometimes in New York, like we do feel a little smoke and mirrors-y, and people will tell you that that's the only way to get to the top is to like make it seem like you're already there, or like, you know, that's how Instagram gets created, right? It's like the highlight reel culture. Like, and so I think that I didn't, and I do think that there was a certain part of my life where I was doing that smoke and mirrors culture. And I remember thinking, it was the first time I'd been able to say and just be honest even with myself and say it out loud, where I was like, I grew up with no money in New York. And I'd never even said that really, like, to my close friends knew, you know, of my background and, you know, how hard it was for my parents. But I remember thinking, like, every single thing she asked me, I was so honest about.
And the fact that she came to that title with your honesty, did that make it more powerful that you didn't have to drive the narrative to what you thought she wanted, but instead you could be completely yourself? Or was the title nothing to do with it at all?
It's so weird because it really was like it didn't have anything to do with it, but it's been a defining title of my career. It's something that, like, you know, anytime someone writes about me, they reference that title from that article. So it's interesting because it has defined it, but it's weird because for me, when I think of that article, I never think about how I felt that title defined me, or even like, you know, it was also like, it's a weird title to get to, as much as it is flattering. It's also just strange because they don't do that to men. You know, they don't, you've never heard of an it boy. You only say it girls. Like, you know, they love to treat us like we can be traded in for a new model. And I think that, you know, Oprah's the only Oprah. There's not going to be a millennial version there of her. She's still here. Yeah. She's still an incredible force for, you know, good and love and all those things. And so
yeah, I get Martha Stewart.
Yeah, you know, and you're just kind of like, really? Like, you know, like Martha Stewart can't just be Martha Stewart in her whole like bit and aesthetic, you know, and I can't just be the only me and like it be a new thing. And so that moment was a tough for me because I was like, it's so flattering and it's so amazing, but it's also, you know, challenging because, you know, Oprah's the only Oprah. But I always think about that moment because I think it was the first time I was like, I can be myself. Authenticity feels better than smoke and mirrors, I guess. And I'm just going to do that. And I remember thinking like, wow, that is so freeing. It was so freeing to be like, this is who I really am. And this is what really like pulls these words together. And this is what I really think. And I'm not trying to overly control it or not look or seem or be a certain way or have my frizzy hair or my crooked teeth or all the things. And I was like, you know what? Okay.
Yeah. You know why? It's because you're the only Cleo Wade.
Yeah. Yes, indeed.
Thank you so much. Thank you for your wisdom and your words and your generosity and your friendship to not just me, but everyone that you write for.
Oh, thank you so much for having me. I'm so proud of you. And this is just such an amazing, it's been so amazing. I've gotten a front row seat to your journey. I'm like emotional. I'm choked up thinking about it. And it's just been amazing to see you and your power and then using your power to, you know, inspire other people to feel powerful. It's the best thing. I'm so proud and happy to know you.
Thank you very much.
I love you.
Appreciate you. I love you too. Thank you, Cleo.
Of course. Thank you.
That was poet, best-selling author, activist, artist, and thought leader, Cleo Wade. Thanks for tuning in to More Than One Thing. Stay tuned for new episodes on Wednesdays, and be sure to subscribe wherever you're listening now. If you enjoyed today's show, I would be so grateful if you could take a moment to rate and review us. And I'd also love your feedback. Which multi-hyphenates would you like to hear on the show? Send guest suggestions or any other feedback to morethanonethingpodcast@gmail.com. And be sure to check us out on our newly launched Instagram account, More Than One Thing Podcast. And you can find me personally on social at iSwoon. If you would like to receive the More Than One Thing newsletter, please head over to i-swoon.com and sign up for the newsletter. I'm Athena Calderone, and you've been listening to More Than One Thing.